From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear from a group of Democratic voters on how they're feeling about this year's presidential election.
The base just wasn't galvanized. People were tuned out. And what we need is more people to be involved, not less. And I think with Biden, unfortunately, especially the younger electorate, they could care less what was going on in politics.
Plus, we'll learn about some new ways that bird collisions are being prevented.
Windows are really reflective. If you look at a window, you often can see the reflection of a tree or a bird feeder. They don't know what a window is and what happens if they hit it. All they see is something that looks like a really nice tree to go perch in.
That's what's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The presidential race has undergone a sudden and major shift. President Joe Biden dropped out of the race in July and quickly endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris to lead the Democratic ticket. Now Harris is running a short but energized campaign against Republican Donald Trump. WUWM has been holding roundtable conversations with local voters since spring to talk about what issues are important to them, how they feel about the candidates, and what's driving voter sentiment. On August 27th, five left-leaning Milwaukee-area voters joined us in our studios to talk about how they're feeling about Harris taking over from Biden and what issues are important to them this election. The conversation was moderated by Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and WUWM's Mayan Silver. A note to our listeners, you'll be hearing people express their own personal and political opinions. Participants' answers may be edited for clarity and length.
So how are you all feeling now that Harris is the official nominee for the Democratic Party? And how is it different than how you felt about Biden? Anyone can start. Feel free to raise your hand if you want to kick it off.
So I think as someone who became a citizen in 2019, my first presidential election was 2020, and it was like, pick the worst of two evils. Sure, I'll vote for Biden because we cannot have another Trump term. You know, he had almost four years to destroy this country and take us into a pandemic. And so this time around, again, I wasn't enthusiastic. Now, once Biden officially made the decision to step away and kind of let Harris step in, I mean, as someone whose parents are Indian, you know, I grew up as a proud Indian in Dubai and in Missouri. I was excited for someone that is half Indian and a female and could be the president of a country that's made of immigrants.
All right. Who else would like to answer how you're feeling now that Harris is the nominee and how it's different than how you felt about Biden? Debbie.
So I can maybe build on that a little bit. I was a Biden supporter. I actually thought that he has been a sort of a remarkable president in a lot of the things he did. But I acknowledge that he's not a young man. Mm-hmm. And that became very clear. So what was interesting is I would have friends say to me, well, and then if something happens to him, you know, Kamala Harris will be in charge. And I said, well, what's wrong with that? That was my response. And like you, my husband is from Bombay, and we have a daughter. And it's interesting that when she became the vice president, I began to cry, which completely surprised me. But I realized how important, you know, even to me, it was that we have this child of immigrants, you know, at this position. And so I've been very excited. I feel that she and her campaign have really done everything right. And I was very aware of the discussions about Gaza. And it is troubling. And I guess I feel like they've been trying to thread this needle in the Middle East, which is like just a most difficult thing. And I feel like I have confidence that they will do the best job available, certainly better than I would do.
Annalee.
So how I felt, it was kind of a gut punch when Joe announced that he was no longer running, you know, withdrawing from the race. And I felt very worried. My instant feeling, I was actually at brunch at my friend's restaurant, and all of a sudden we're all sitting there talking. And I said, who are they going to get that has kind of that incumbent advantage, right? Who has that name recognition? Who can we kind of go full force? And my friend was like, well, Michelle Obama. And I was like, you know, so we got into these discussions about how that is something that she's been very clearly like, I do not want to be president, like politics, you know, not in that way. I was a supporter of Joe Biden. I was a proud supporter of Joe Biden in 2020 because I saw what that Trump presidency looked like. I saw what the impact was on our domestic policy. I saw what the impact was on decorum in politics. I saw just kind of the fiasco, what I felt like was with foreign policy. So I was kind of tired. I was tired of the way that kind of politics was going in the country. And I felt that Joe Biden was going to be kind of a buoy for all of us, right? Like I felt that he was going to be the one to kind of hold us and kind of keep us closer to what our democratic norms were. And I feel like he did do that. I felt like he led us through a pandemic pretty successfully from where we were. I just felt like he was just kind of a steadying force for us during these last 4 years. So I was a bit sad because I just kind of seeing kind of how the media kind of came at him for his age when also looking at Donald Trump is also old, like, you know, like an elderly man. So I felt like kind of the targeting for Joe was a bit unfair, considering that both are not, you know, spring chickens here. Right. How I feel now about Kamala, I am very happy to actually see how that like this campaign is just it feels very alive. Right. People are excited. And I think as a woman, that's really exciting for me. I voted for Clinton in 2016, you know, hoping that was gonna be our first female president. And I said, actually, online, let's not fail Kamala. Like, let's not do that. And I'm very excited for her because I teach a lot of my girls are Black girls. That's somebody who is them, right, in the office. Like, Black girls can look at that. I also look at, like, you know, Asian students. Like, that's also your representation. So I'm excited just to see how she gets people to the polls. It's such a quick turnaround. You know, she had, what, 100 days? Roughly when, you know, Joe Biden endorsed her. So I think she's actually done a pretty remarkable job considering it's just kind of a quick turnaround from where we've been. So
Nate or Tynetta, either of you want to answer how you're feeling now that Harris is the nominee and how it felt compared to when Biden was?
I think everybody hit on some good points, but just to reiterate, this is a good opportunity to galvanize the base again, get everybody more excited and focused on the mission at hand. And me being a father of two young daughters, they're more involved now. It's no longer something theoretical that they can achieve. They can actually see it. It's in front of them. So I'm excited for that. But yeah, I'm just looking forward. I'm hopeful.
When we were speaking with you before this roundtable, you mentioned you had a bit of a frustration with the Democratic Party's lack of a succession plan. Do you still feel that way, that it could have been better organized or, you know, less of a time crunch? Or are you mainly just excited and ready to go behind the nominee that's currently here?
You mentioned, you used the word steady. Biden was steady. And, you know, steady doesn't give us the opportunity to change things. And I think with Kamala now, I think she brings a new focus, a new energy. So I'm excited for her receiving the nomination, but I do believe the succession plan should have been in place. Those conversations should have took place. Should have had those conversations.
And Tynetta, how about for you?
Well, initially I wasn't happy with Biden or Trump. I wasn't a fan of either or. I was a fan of Biden and I voted for him the last election, but this election, he said he was gonna run one term and that was it. I felt the Democrats, I kind of feel the way Nate does or did. They should have been more prepared to have a candidate ready. And I think that the Democratic Party is always reactive instead of proactive. Why are we, well, I'm saying independent for myself now, because I'm just so frustrated with that party of always being reactive. After something happened, then you react. You should be preparing your candidates, know who can take that place, know who's going to run. They should have had a candidate
ready to run after Biden. They should have been already vetted, already ready to step in the place. So I was a little frustrated. Now that Kamala is the candidate for the Democratic Party, I'm very hopeful. I'm very happy to see that she is the candidate, and I feel the same way. She's bringing some new ideas of and new ways of thinking that I think is going to be fresh and good for the Democratic Party. So, yeah, I wasn't happy in the beginning. I was very frustrated with him trying to run another term.
This is Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski here with reporter Mayon Silver. We're talking to a roundtable of five left-leaning Milwaukee area voters about what's on their minds ahead of the November presidential election.
What's happening right now at this moment? I mean, we're past the DNC. Harris and Walz are the candidates for the Democrats. They're trying to, you know, there's been reporting about how they're going around to battleground states all around the country to reintroduce joy into the campaign. And that's kind of the moment that national organizations are reporting about. You know, there were DJs at the DNC. There were, you know, jokes and memes and everything like that. Is that affecting you right here on the ground? Is that coming through to you? And is that, are you mobilized in any different ways that you might not have been before, whether that's, you know, putting up a yard sign, door knocking, you know, phone banking, anything like that? And, you know, we can go ahead and start with whoever wants to go.
My position, I'm still silent in my position in supporting Harris, but I think what's happened now is there's a lot more energy, a lot more conversations around the dinner table with the family. You know, a lot of people in my family have gone out to volunteer, sign up, door knocking, as you mentioned, yard signs. You know, I definitely see that taking place.
Go ahead, Debbie.
So what I have enjoyed about it, and the other thing is when I said, well, what's wrong with Kamala? And then people would say, have you heard her laugh? And I'd said, so what? So what? I mean, you know, and so I love that they've made a big deal out of her laugh and the fact that, you know, she does embrace joy, because we see such a dystopian world from the Republicans, right? And from Donald Trump. It's just like, everything is horrible. America is horrible. Well, guess what? America's not horrible. We actually have pulled through the pandemic better than almost, you know, maybe any country in the world. And we have a right to feel joyous. We have a right to feel patriotic. We have a right to feel proud of our country, do you know? And I think that that made all of us like stand a little bit taller and quit thinking, oh, what's going to happen? So for me, it's really been wonderful to see the, you know, outpouring of joy and laughter and enthusiasm. And I know it's made a difference in the volunteer base, in the work I do. You know, when are the yard signs coming, right? It's just, I hope that it, that energy is, before I felt like the state candidates, because I'm very involved, as I said, with the state elections because of gerrymandering, and they were out working hard and they were joyous, and it was like, will the top of the ticket be a drag? And I don't feel that way anymore. So,
all right, Annalie, go ahead.
Yeah, I really like your point on talking about just like the tone of each kind of campaign here, because I also feel the same thing. And I think it's really interesting because I don't think the Trump campaign has been able to pivot, right, quite as quickly as you would think. Donald Trump is really predictable to me, right? Like whoever it was just going to be like these ad hominem like attacks. Like that was just what was going to happen. So I was just kind of ready, like, which name is he going to have for Kamala? And, you know, Kamabla, that's what he came up with. So I think what I really do like about her campaign is, right, it's just so nearly polar opposite. What I do like to see is just like kind of online discourse. A lot of what I'm seeing is like younger people, college age students, or even like I'm seeing people who weren't necessarily as involved becoming like increasingly involved on social media. For me personally, I feel like I'm just as involved as I ever was. My methods, like my modes of like campaigning now are slightly different. When I was younger, I was knocking on doors. I was doing phone banks. Now I just I feel like my personality has changed a little bit. I don't feel like going to doors anymore, right?
You talk to the people that you know.
So I have conversations, you know, within like kind of my circle, you know, people that I know. I donate now money to campaigns because, you know, that's just kind of the easiest for me right now. So I do think this whole thing is interesting, right? They're just very stark campaigns.
Go ahead, Sagar.
For me, it almost feels like things have come around full circle. So I got involved, you know, first time I took out a packet by myself. I lived in Northern Virginia for a year in 08. And just that momentum and just the joy and enthusiasm that was in the crowd. I remember attending a rally there in Springfield, Virginia, and there were over 100,000 people there. And it was just this space where I felt like, you know, Barack Obama was about a mile away and you had your little crappy phone that you tried to zoom in on, but you heard that voice and it was like that voice of hope. And feel like we've come around full circle to 16 years later now with Kamala, and she is reinvigorating another generation. My generation's turn is done. We did our part with 08 and 12, and I mean, we're still engaged, but, you know, we have kids and that keeps our lives busy. But there's another generation, you know, the Gen Z coming up that need those memes and things to catch on to. And I think this campaign has done that.
You were talking about social media and the younger generations, and Annalee was talking about that. There have been a lot of viral moments since this campaign has switched. Basically, we've got Brett Summer, we've got the coconut tree, Vance going to the donut shop, childless cat lady, hotties for Harris. There's a lot of pop culture moments. If you need any explanations for any of them, I've got you. But
thank you.
Has there been a pop culture moment that stood out to you and or any of these that sound particularly intriguing? Go ahead, Annalee.
Oh, I did the Meg Thee Stallion when she did her little, when she was in Atlanta at the Harris rally when she was doing her new viral TikTok dance. And that's the only reason I actually know that dance, because I was watching Meg Thee Stallion do that. And this is the first TikTok trend I've ever tried to do. So I do see it's, you know, I feel like social media is really interesting too, because I feel like I'm really myopic with it, right? Like as soon as one trend hits, it's like boom, out, boom, out. So I do think that just with the four personalities between, you know, the two main parties running, there are so many viral moments. I think they keep giving us kind of content unintentionally, maybe intentionally. I don't know what their true strategy is. But I feel like this is like, is this the new era of politics? I'd be kind of curious to see like what maybe political scientists say, because I know they're writing right now, researching right now, if this is like the new avenue for like engagement, right? Like, how is this going to change how we are actually involved, like, democratically? I kind of think about all the old things, like NES out of the University of Michigan, like their big data set, right, where they go and interview, you know, thousands of people. I'm like, are they going to start putting, like, social media on there, right, like engaging in on these apps? So I think that's kind of fascinating, that I feel like we're expanding our scope a little bit about what it means to be democratically engaged with all these trends.
Go ahead, Debbie.
Well, I was just going to say I'm probably the only one who actually can remember or was around in 1960 when television became important in elections with the Kennedy election. And as somebody who is 70 years old and I see a few TikTok things, but I'm not very engaged with it, it's been very interesting to sort of stand a little bit at the distance and watch those viral moments.
What I find interesting, I'm sorry, I'm going off a little bit. I talk to the community a lot, and what's really interesting for me is that there is a lot of men do not want a woman president, and they will not vote for her just because she's a woman. And that's all racist, black men, white men. And we know white men, they just don't want to see it change over because they want to stay at the head and, you know, so I'm seeing a lot of that when I go out in the community. Because we were talking about platforms, and I said, let's just lay it side by side. And when we got down to it, I was with a group of men, and I said, so you're really not talking about what the issues are and what's in each other's platform. You're just mad she's a woman. And that was it.
What's your message to people when you come across them like that?
My message is, so do you want to live in a world of dictatorship, or or would you like to continue to have your democracy and freedom?
Anna Lee.
Yeah, I also see kind of what you're seeing, too, because when you see this, like the criticisms of Kamala Harris and kind of reading online as well, it's people ask the question, like, who did she sleep with to get the positions that she got? Donald Trump would never be asked that question, right? Like, we can, with full certainty, and the man has not been in, you know, public service, like, he's known for being in the private sector.
Right.
So my question would also be, you know, how was he prepared for the highest office in the land? So, yeah, just seeing the criticism coming her way for someone who is quite accomplished, it's really unfortunate to see. I'm not surprised. Because, you know, we kind of saw that stuff before. We've seen rhetoric with this surrounding female candidates before.
Go ahead, Zeiger.
To Annalise's comment about, you know, who has she slept with, we don't have to ask who Donald Trump slept with because we keep finding out. So, I mean, I think also what this comes down to is kind of comparing, you know, I think she did a very good job at picking Tim Walz as her vice presidential candidate because I feel like he's way more relatable, like as a teacher. And again, you know, there were so many teacher memes that came out of his pick. You know, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are about 6 months apart in age. And this is what happens when you're a high school teacher. Like, that was my number one. And I'll probably use that for a while. So it comes down to a comparison between who are these, like, per se, normal educated people that went to, you know, state colleges, did not go to, I believe J.D. Vance went to Yale for law school and Trump went to Penn, maybe?
Yeah, he did go to Penn.
So, you know, who are these people that I feel like I can relate to them more. And that's what they've tried to put out. Like, look, we're everyday people versus, you know, because I'm a woman, I should be in this spot or whatever it is. So I feel like the campaign does a good job, to Debbie's point, you know, focusing on topics versus what their identity is.
This is Like Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski here with reporter Mayon Silver. We're talking to a roundtable of five left-leaning Milwaukee area voters about what's on their minds ahead of the November presidential election.
So we've been talking about the feel and the energy that's kind of been reinvigorated into the party. And of course, a party is surrounding the issues that it stands on, right? So for all of you here today, what issue is most important to you in this election? You know, some examples from polls of Wisconsin voters include the economy, abortion policy, immigration, to name a few. For you, what's the most important thing? Anna Lee.
Reproductive rights are my biggest thing. What it translates into, kind of like these personal liberties, like my right to privacy. It's really interesting, like a lot of like the conservative talking points are right, like we don't like big government, we don't like big government. And to me, some of the most, I think, like private moments, I don't like the fact that there's this kind of overreach, limitation of the decisions I can make. Consistently, that's been like my top issue. And this election is no different.
How about for you, Nate?
Yeah, I would definitely second that. Reproductive rights is definitely a hot button issue that I strongly feel, being a father of two daughters. And I think it's like the tip of an iceberg. You know, when you talk to about reproductive rights, I feel like government shouldn't be in the exam room. It should be you. It should be between you and your medical provider to make those decisions. If that doesn't change, it's just a matter of time before it's something else when it comes to healthcare, you know? So reproductive rights is definitely at the top of my list.
Anyone else want to speak on most important issues for them?
I would also echo that, but along with that, I would say education. Coming from a place where education was so important and moving to this country in the middle of high school, and then just like, I have seen a downturn of our education system here, and now being inside of it, we can do a whole lot better, but it has to start with investment from the early childhood. And we can see examples of it under the Tim Walz administration in Minnesota. And I feel like we can do that nationally. And that's, it's going to take a whole generation of investment to turn our education system back around to where we can put, you know, we put a man on the moon, maybe we can put a man on Mars, but it's going to take a generation of investment to do that.
Thanks, Sanger. Debbie.
So I loved it when she chose Tim Walz. I happened to be from Minnesota, so I knew, at least I knew who he was, and he reminded me of my father, and I think a lot of people have said, well, he reminds me of my father too, so that was very encouraging for me. And I liked his phrase where he say, mind your own damn business, or whatever the phrase was that he used, I thought was really, really good when it came to issues like reproductive rights. My personal thing is that I think that the economy is actually a pretty big deal. And it continues to amaze me that the Republicans, you know, supposedly score better on that one. I sort of don't understand why the Democrats don't get the credit that I believe they deserve for economic growth, because I really believe strongly that when you grow the middle class, I'm a raise all boats person, right? And when you grow the middle class, everybody benefits. And under the Trump administration, when he gave that tax cut to the super rich in December of 2017, I wrote my first letter to the editor and I compared it to, I said, maybe the ghost of Christmas past, you know, he's like, what he did and the ghost of Christmas past will come back and haunt him. And so it hasn't so far, unfortunately. But anyway, I think the economy is big. And frankly, I'm glad that she's leaned into it, you know, and so I'm happy about that.
Thank you. Tynetta, how about for you? Any top issues? There's a lot to pick from.
It is so many, and I'm so passionate about all of them. I'm passionate about education, reproductive. I'm so passionate about clean air. That is so important. I was up there protesting with Jane Fonda when she was up north with the water, Line 5. Mm-hmm. So many people are not aware about the water that we're drinking and how important that is. So that is really, I'm really passionate about that. I'm passionate about war. Let's end war. So I can't choose one because all of them are good. I'm just so, I can speak forever on all of them because they are so important to me. And making sure that elderly people keep their benefits, you know, that is so important. I don't want to see him in the middle class. And I think under the Trump leadership, I feel that there will be no middle class. It will be poor and the 1%. So, it's too many. I'm passionate about all of them.
Thank you.
All of the above, says Tynetta. So, you know, what we're talking about are the issues, top issues that are important to you. This is, as you've mentioned before, a really short campaign cycle that Harris has to get everybody on board with her. Is there a policy or policies that you don't necessarily know from her that you'd like to know more about from the Harris campaign? And what is that? Go ahead, Zach.
For me, it would be immigration. A comprehensive immigration reform plan. As someone who lived here for 19 years before I was a citizen, I had paid taxes that I did not have a right to collect to if something was to happen to me for almost 16 years. And just going through the whole system was a mess. Sometimes it felt like the system did not know its own laws and the amount of money that was spent on it. Can completely understand why, you know, people come here per se illegally, because people are desperate and people leave and not everybody has resources. And I was fortunate to have parents who worked hard and made that dream happen. But a plan to make sure that people that are already here working hard pay into the system, that's an increase in the tax base, and then have a right or a path to, if not citizenship, at least residency to start with. How are we going to accomplish that for the 11 million plus that are already here and more coming from the autocracies and dictatorships that are forming in Latin and South America currently? So,
thanks, Sucker. Okay, Nate, is there something that you would want to know more about when it comes to the Harris platform?
Well, probably just a little bit more on her clean energy. You know, she had that whole fracking situation where her position was, she said she kind of flip-flopped. But that's just on a personal level. So I would say that.
Interesting. Okay. Anyone else?
I think what I've been kind of just hearing, listening to Trump, calling her like a border czar and all these things, I'd like a little bit more of what is her plan related specifically to like that kind of border issue, right? If that's a real allegation kind of getting hit her way, what is kind of the rebut to that? Another thing that I think kind of the elephant in the room, the big elephant in the room is the, you know, Israeli-Palestinian crisis. It kind of like it was alluded to a little bit earlier is not necessarily kind of, I think it was have your cake and eat it too, right? It's such a sensitive issue and, you know, kind of personally kind of impacting me. I would like to kind of have like kind of a very clear, like she says she's going to support Israel. What does support for Israel look like, right? We say we're going to do things for Palestinians. What does that look like? And I would like to learn a little bit more about how she's going to navigate that relationship with Netanyahu. I have my own personal feelings on him as the leader of Israel and what that means for like my Jewish values. So I'd be very clear, like he and Obama were very frosty, right? He and Trump are, you know, thick as thieves, right? What is that relationship going to be like? Because he has his own politics going on with what's happening out there. So I would be interested to see how she navigates if and when she wins, what is that going to look like specifically, right?
I belong to an organization that almost everyone in that organization feels, you know, that they want more clear understanding of what she's going to do. So you're right. That is a big elephant in the room because people, they don't feel like she gave a clear plan. That's why a lot of people vote
uninstructed.
Yeah, uninstructed. So, and a lot of people in my some of my groups really are passionate about it. But what I have challenged them with, and I don't mean any disrespect to anyone, is that you're holding her foot to the fire on it. What did you do with Trump?
Right.
I said, why is it all the time it happens? It's a, oh, what is she going to do? Or what is this? Did you go to Trump and say, what are you going to do? What do you think that picture is going to look like if Trump is in office?
Yeah, to echo what you're saying, it's one thing to understand her position, but it's another thing for us to have realistic expectations for what she can actually get accomplished when she is in the Oval Office. And I think we need to balance those things out because the last thing we want to do is we prop her up only to shoot her down when we don't get everything that we want that's on that list. So that's why I was just hammering reproductive rights. We got to go for the W's when they're in front of us. Mm-hmm. You know, 'cause when you fall short, she doesn't have the latitude to where people are going to be like, oh, well, okay, nice try. You know, it's going to be a lot worse for her, unfortunately.
Would you have said the same thing about Biden, that, you know, you got to give him some leeway depending on what he's working against?
That's a good question. That's a real good question. I just think when we had Biden in office, again, there was no issues or questions whether or not they were qualified for the position. It was just that the base just wasn't galvanized. People were tuned out. And what we need is more people to be involved, not less. And I think with Biden, unfortunately, you know, especially the younger electorate, they could care less what was going on in politics.
So in a way, it comes down to personality instead of policy, potentially?
As far as galvanizing the base, unfortunately, I would say yes. You know, personality. If you want to get the electorate charged up, you got to have that personality. You know, policy, yeah, that you know, that's important too, but.
So it sounds like all of you at this table are going to vote for Harris in November, no matter what. All right.
Everyone's nodding their head.
That's right. I don't know what would ever happen for me to vote for Donald Trump. I can't even imagine.
That was a group of Wisconsin voters. Annalise Sapansky, Nate Gary, Debbie Patel, Tyneta Jackson, and Sagar Talani. This was WUWM's third voter roundtable. And you can listen back to our previous conversations with more Wisconsin voters at WUWM.com. Our voter roundtables are just one part of our 2024 election coverage. Join us tomorrow to learn more about some of the other ways we're working to make our election coverage useful and accessible to you. In just a moment, we'll learn about bird collisions, what causes them, and what's being done to prevent them, including ways you can make changes at your home to help birds. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Fall migration is already underway, but it's a harrowing journey back north for the hundreds of bird species flying through Wisconsin. Window collisions are a leading cause of bird deaths, causing up to 3.5 billion bird deaths in the U.S. each year. For this month's Chirp Chat, Lake Effect's Exgrit Nunez spoke about the ongoing efforts to make places more bird-friendly, with Brenna Marsicek from the Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance and Lisa Gomnitz from SOS Save Our Songbirds. Marsicek first explains why birds are vulnerable to window collisions.
So there are a few main drivers for why birds hit windows, and the first has to do with what they see in it. So windows are really reflective. If you look at a window, you often can see the reflection of a tree or a bird feeder. They don't know what a window is and what happens if they hit it. All they see is something that looks like a really nice tree to go perch in. So the reflection is a really big driver for collisions. Another problem is that sometimes the way that buildings are laid out, the windows can run parallel to each other. So imagine like a window on the front side of the house and a set of windows on the back side of the house, and you can see straight through both sets of windows. It's called a pass-through effect. So it creates this illusion that a bird could fly right through what looks like open space, and then instead it, you know, hits the hard surface of glass. A lot of songbirds, which are primarily the birds that are affected by window collisions, a lot of songbirds migrate at night. And so having lights on is an important thing to be conscious of, because birds are attracted to light, especially in the dead of nighttime. So while the lights themselves don't kill birds, the glass does. The actual draw effect of those lights on is significant as well. And then just like the basic physiology of a bird, songbirds' eyes are placed on the sides of their heads so that they can better see predators around them, but it changes the way that they perceive depth, right? Especially for something that's reflective like glasses. And so birds also have hollow bones to make them light enough that they can fly, which also means that if they hit something hard, they're much more fragile and likely to get severely injured from it.
And I know there's a volunteer program that you mentioned called the Bird Collision Corps. Can you tell me a little bit about the work that these volunteers do?
Yes, that's a great question. So the Bird Collision Corps is a volunteer citizen science program that Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, in partnership with a number of other groups, UW-Madison, the Dane County Humane Society Wildlife Center, American Bird Conservancy, and then a bunch of site hosts. So we all work together to train volunteers, and those volunteers go out to their assigned building once a week during spring and fall migration, and they're looking for evidence that a bird has hit a window in that spot. Sometimes they find it and sometimes they don't. So evidence of a bird hitting a window would be a dead bird below the window, injured bird that's still alive, probably near the windows, and a smudge or feathers stuck to the window. So the volunteers conduct their surveys by walking around the base of the building and following the protocol for where to scan the ground to look for birds. And then if they find a bird, they document it using iNaturalist. And we have projects within iNaturalist set up for this program. So then at the end of the season, after all these volunteers have spent hundreds of hours surveying buildings in the Madison area, we analyze it and then we report out both to the volunteers and to the site hosts, the building owners, so that ideally if our volunteers have found a collision hotspot, we have a way to suggest that the window be addressed to reduce collisions in the future. A lot of it has to do with what you were saying about, you know, wanting to collect data. This is a really big reason why we do this. The issue of window collisions has been well studied, you know, throughout the country and around the world. But in a lot of cases, you know, it's human nature to think, yeah, but here, like, how do we know this is happening here? And so this is a way for us to gauge the magnitude of the problem in the Madison area and then ideally put that information to work. So this data set that our Bird Collision Corps volunteers collected helped put together and influence the Bird Safe Glass Ordinance in Madison that was passed in 2020 and then, you know, went through some litigation, was cleared in the end of 2023, and then Middleton passed the matching ordinance in early 2024. And so it's like kind of the ripple effects of a project like this is really incredible and inspiring, and I hope empowering for the volunteers who participate in it.
Can you tell me more about that Madison became the first city in the state to enact this bird-friendly law? Can you tell me a little bit more about like the details of how this came to fruition?
Yeah, so in the early stages of conversations about this ordinance, there was a lot of questions about, like, you know, Madison is in a great natural area. We have the lakes, we have tons of natural areas here, we have lots of people who garden for birds. So it seems to fit that if we are so proud of our natural resources that we do something to protect them, right? So with the Bird Collision Corps data, we are having conversations with folks at UW and American Bird Conservancy and then the city about this bird safe glass ordinance idea. There are other cities that have passed ordinances like this. Toronto was the first, I believe. At this time when we were talking about doing this in Madison, New York City had just passed a really strong ordinance. You know, there are a bunch of different cities that have similar ordinances and have done it successfully. So, you know, we wanted to be able to support the city in coming up with a solution to new construction projects that would ensure that if they're going to be designed in this modern glassy aesthetic, that they do it in a way that doesn't add to the problem of billions of birds dying every year. So, you know, fortunately, there are solutions to this. There are glass companies that bake or etch a pattern into the glass. It's called FRIT, F-R-I-T. And so those patterns are in the production stage of glass. And so they come to the building already bird safe. And there are lots of other ways a person can design a building that uses less glass or uses it in a different way. Maybe there's a solar shade or some kind of screen that goes on the outside of the glass, you know, to be able to just be a little more cognizant of our impact on birds and collisions. So the ordinance requires that any building that is 10,000 square feet or more that uses a certain amount of glass use bird safe glass. So that could be FRIT, like the pattern that's baked or etched into the glass. And that FRIT would have to be in a 2-inch by 2-inch grid or spacing in some way where nothing on the glass is more than 2 inches apart from something else. That 2-inch rule is really important because birds are really great at flying. They can try and squeeze through tiny spaces, especially small birds like hummingbirds. And so that 2-inch rule makes sure that it's the most effective pattern on the glass to reduce collisions. So in addition to these large buildings that use a large amount of glass, it also includes like bus stops. As you can see in Madison, there are a lot of new bus stops coming in because, you know, the city is redoing their bus route. So all these bus stops that are all glass use bird safe glass. So, you know, anything that's at the ground level that is fully glass needs to use like a frit pattern or some way of preventing birds from hitting the glass.
So how can people at home make bird-friendly windows for themselves?
I love that question. Homeowners have lots of options. And in fact, there are so many options, it can be a bit overwhelming. Fortunately, American Bird Conservancy is a national nonprofit. They've done a ton of research on this. They have a database where they've tested methods for making windows bird safe and then given them a score for how effective they are. So some really good options that we like to recommend are, I'll just list a few and talk about each of them. Insect screens are a really great starting point. They're super effective at reducing collisions. They have one of the best scores you can get for window treatments that American Bird Conservancy gives out. Some other sort of do-it-yourself options. A lot of people really like paracord curtains. These are dangling strings in front of the window. It goes on the outside of the window. And they're made from paracord, which is a nylon slippery material that's used in parachutes. So it doesn't get tangled up. It doesn't like attract all the debris and get gunked up with leaves and ice and whatnot. It doesn't decompose quickly, and they're really effective. So these strings are spaced out every few inches, and then they kind of move in the breeze. And the bird sees them moving. They can see it's a 3D object and that there's something there. Then they shouldn't try to get to it. So people also really like the dots. You may have seen these dots in different windows, but they are a small, like a quarter inch wide dot or tiny square that is spaced out 2 inches apart from each other. So it forms kind of a grid on the window. Oil-based markers are another nice option. They're a weatherproof thing that you can buy online, you know, or in craft store, but look for the oil-based marker indicator. And you can draw a design on the outside of the glass. It could be dots or lines or whatever design you put on there, whatever window treatment you choose. You shouldn't leave any gaps that are more than 2 inches wide. That's the rule of thumb. That has been studied by American Bird Conservancy as the most effective way to reduce collisions, is to make sure that everything is 2 inches or closer together.
Well, at the end of every Chirp Chat, I love for guests to shine a spotlight on a bird for the month. So I would like to ask each of you, what bird would you like to highlight this month? Brenna, I'll start with you.
I'm going to highlight a bird that doesn't usually get impacted by window collisions, if that's okay. Is the bald eagle. The bald eagle is such a wonderful conservation success story where not that long ago, 50, 60 years ago, they were on the brink, and through a lot of different people working together and being thoughtful about the ways that our actions impact birds. You know, we eliminated DDT from the environment, which was a big thing for bald eagles and other raptors. You know, we worked together with different groups to be able to save habitat and clean up the water. And so it's just like such a wonderful way to represent collaboration and, you know, people being intentional about saving things that they care about. And everybody loves bald eagles. Like, everyone has a bald eagle story. And when we see them, you know, even though they're fairly common in Wisconsin now, every time you see one, it just kind of makes you pause and enjoy it. So, you know, this time of year is fun because there are these big, full-size, fully grown, but immature bald eagles flying around that are dark brown from head to tail. And it's just such a wonderful sign of, you know, this is success in conservation. This is one example. And that, you know, we did it once, we can do it again.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing.
Oh my gosh, that's so hard. What a hard, high bar. I should. they'll know that I'm the backyard birder in the pair here. My favorite bird to watch at this time of the year would be the American goldfinch. I should say they're a small bird that has a bright yellow color. It's got black wing that has some little white stripes on them. And it's just, it's almost like a flying lemon. It's that bright and vibrant yellow. And it has kind of a bouncy flight pattern. It's one that's attracted to feeders, so it's likely that people are seeing it around their home if they've got a feeder, but also if they're going to kind of weedy edges and prairies like that, they'll see it as well. But I believe it's the latest nester in Wisconsin, and so it's one that you know, people can look for still feeding young and things like that. And sometimes they don't take off until late September.
I love that. And just similar to the American goldfinch and the bald eagle, I will always remember the first time I saw each of them. So, well, thank you both so much for speaking with me today and helping me learn so much more about making places more bird friendly.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been so fun.
Brenna Marsicek is the Director of Outreach for the Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance. Lisa Gomnitz is the coordinator for SOS Save Our Songbirds. They spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez for a monthly series we call Chirp Chat. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn why UW-Milwaukee temporarily suspended several student groups and what that means for those groups as a new school year begins. Plus, we'll look at this year's cicada emergence. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.